Most business podcasts today focus on the 1%, the nationally known larger-than-life personalities, entrepreneurs, and celebrities with interesting business stories. Business Exit Stories shares the stories of the other 99% of unheralded entrepreneurs that own successful companies in manufacturing, retail, logistics, telecommunications, construction, food service, and in every imaginable type of business in every state and city around the country. These are the stories told by the deal makers that facilitate exits. These are the mergers and acquisition specialists, business brokerages, financial and wealth planners, CPAs, appraisers, and attorneys. By listening to their stories, you'll learn what the entrepreneurs and business owners they represent did right and what they did wrong when it comes to exiting their business through a sale or a merger. In fact, you'll not only learn how they avoided disastrous exits, but how they positioned their companies for an out-of-the-ballpark home run when they exited their business. And here's your host, Marvin L. Storm.
Today we are talking to Peter Coleman, who is based in Las Vegas. Peter shares with us a transaction with a client that was a cabinet maker that had real old-world woodworking skills. In fact, you would call him a craftsman. And he just loved what he did. Since none of his children were willing to take over the business, his wife encouraged him to sell. However, he just couldn't bring himself to signing the purchase agreement to sell the business. The reasons he didn't want to sell is not what you might think. Then Peter shares how a business that needed a special purpose building facility and how it was paid for quickly because the business was profitable enough to pay off the mortgage very quickly. Since the owners didn't need the money, they didn't charge the business rent. Learn how by not paying fair market value rent eventually led to the business being closed. Peter finally talks about leaving a business to the kids and how this turned out to be a really bad idea for one of his clients. Finally, he talks about a junkyard business that had a very good, solid business model and made good business decisions with the EPA issues that were involved in the business and how this allowed the business to be sold for millions. This is Marvin L. Storm with the Business Exit Stories podcast. We're here with Peter Coleman, who's based out of Las Vegas. Peter, would you take a few minutes and introduce yourself?
Yes, good afternoon to everybody. This is Peter Coleman. I'm the managing partner with Sunbelt Business Brokers here in Las Vegas. I've been with Sunbelt for nearly 25 years now in different parts of the country and ended up in lovely Las Vegas about 3 years ago.
Okay, great, Peter. Well, Peter's going to share with us some stories that he's been involved in on transactions, that some of which went well and some were a little bit more challenging. So, Peter, would you share, first of all, some of the transactions with your clients that were a little bit more challenging?
Well, whenever anybody wants to sell their business, especially a business that they founded maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago, one seller told me it was like selling their child. I remember down in New Orleans, which is where I first started in this business, a gentleman had a very nice cabinet making business, and it was 7 o'clock in the evening. I'm sitting at his kitchen table. He's got an almost full price offer, which in and of itself is quite rare, but he just couldn't bring himself to pick up his pen to sign it. And his wife came in the kitchen and she's going 100 miles an hour and asking him, "Haven't you got that done yet? Come on, come on. We've got the cruise planned." And she was off to a meeting. I think it was the garden committee that evening or whatever. And she's obviously very busy. And eventually she's gone. And he just looked at me across the table and said, "It's all right for her. What am I going to do?" This lady was basically on every committee known to man, very active in the community. They had a son in the military in Japan, and she'd figured out a cruise going out of Hawaii to go and see the son and the grandkids and that sort of thing. And he really had nothing else apart from his business. He wasn't a golfer, and his business, to a large extent, was his identity in the community. So he was having a tough time. We eventually got the deal done, but he was having a tough time in letting go because outside the business, he really didn't have a plan. He didn't have that much, you know, to do. Spent all his working life building this very successful business and didn't have much interest outside the business. But obviously, you can't go on forever.
Well, in this situation, I would imagine being a cabinet maker, and if he'd been in the business for a long time, he probably had some of these old world craftsman skills that seem to be lost in our modern world here today. And he probably took a lot of pride in what he did and had some real, very specific skills that he got a lot of satisfaction of what he created. And what you're telling me is that he just didn't have a lot of other interests because he loved what he did.
One thing I remember that made me smile, I always ask a seller when I'm getting engaged for the first meeting, you know, what are you going to do when you retire? And this chap said to me, oh, I'm going to buy a Harley. I'm going to ride around the country. And that's not uncommon as a goal for people when they retire. I've heard that many, many times. But I said to him, but you've already got big bikes. He had Honda Goldwings, Norton Commandos. He already rode big bikes. So I said, well, you know, why buy the Harley? And he explained to me that because of that typical throb that the Harley produces, which it's famous for, which everybody likes, every time you take a Harley out, even if it's only for an hour's drive, when you come back, you should be prepared to spend another half an hour or so just tightening all those nuts and bolts down again. Because if you don't, you're going to have problems later on. And sure enough, I discovered subsequently that the local Harley dealership was backed up for 2 or 3 months with people trying to get bikes in for repair because they didn't do the preventive maintenance that was required. But he knew that he didn't have time to have a Harley when he had his business to run. But he was going to have that Harley once he'd sold his business.
So I guess the real takeaway to your exit story here is that you have a cabinet maker. His life was his business. His identity was tied up in his business. And he really couldn't answer the question, you know, what are you going to do after you sell your business? And that was why it was so difficult for him to pick up the pen and execute a purchase agreement. And where you asked your Harley rider friend that he knew exactly what he was going to be doing. So he had a very clear vision of what he's going to be doing after he exited his business. So I guess the takeaway really is that you need to come to grips with yourself on really what you're going to be doing after the sale, or leaving your business can be a pretty traumatic experience. Well, let's move on to another transaction that may have a good takeaway too, that perhaps had some challenges to it and may have turned out well or not so well. So why don't you share another transaction story with us?
Well, several years later, in fact, not in the New Orleans area, but more in the Atlantic coast area where I was working, got a call from an attorney trying to basically see if he could help a family sell a business that the father had left to his two children. They both worked in the business.
What kind of business was it?
It was a large construction-related business. Both the son and the daughter worked in it, in different capacities, obviously. And in order to be fair, he left it to them 50-50. He passed on. And they, unfortunately, fought like cats and dogs, couldn't agree to anything. And the business just went slowly downhill, downhill. Till by the time the attorney called us to try and help, it was too far gone.
Was this construction company had been around a long time? And was it a good sized one or well known in the community?
Very well known in the community. It was the largest in its area in that community, in its particular sphere. And he basically had been around for 25, 30 years, well-established company. And there's nothing, you know, unfortunately, when we saw where the business was, there wasn't anything we could do to help them. It was losing money. It had a lot of inventory, and there wasn't anything we could do.
So we have a situation here where, as you said, the children, I guess you said it was a son and daughter?
Yes.
And they had worked in the business before, but I guess when the dad was around, he kind of made all the decisions and made the trains run on time and decisions got made. But once he was gone, there wasn't any real agreement. And because they were 50-50 owners, decisions really couldn't get done.
Exactly. I've always, and this goes back to even before I was in this business, I was a banker many, many years ago, and I was told by our in-house counsel at the time, if you get two people wanting to go into business together, never let them go in 50-50. Advise them to take 49%, 49%, and leave 2% with either their attorney or their CPA or somebody they both trust to make decisions, to make the have the casting vote. 50-50 will lead to nothing getting done.
So in this particular situation where the kids had that 50-50 and not 49-49, 2% like your bank and hound counsel had recommended, is that decision didn't get made, then over time, you're telling me the business profits and sales just plummeted until where the business is really not a saleable entity at that time.
No, exactly.
So I guess the big takeaway here is that business owners that have partners or family members is to have a mechanism in place to make sure that decisions can be made, and 50-50 ownership and decision-making authority is probably not a good idea. And in this particular case, you took a business that had been around for 25 or 30 years, the largest in the region at the time, and took that business right down to zero.
Pretty much so. And if you want to leave your business to your children because they work in the business, you need to start thinking about this probably 4 or 5 years before the event happens, before you want to exit the business. You need to give some thought to it. I'm also a certified exit planner, and this is what we do for people who come to us in good time. If you get together with a good exit planner and produce a document and produce a plan to leave a business, not only will you achieve more in terms of a sale price for the business, but if you wish to pass it on to your children or to your employees, if you set it up properly, that problem can be solved and you will get paid for your business.
All right, Peter, why don't you talk a little bit about another transaction that had some challenges to it and perhaps had challenges because of the way the business was structured?
Well, the biggest issue I see, have always seen and continue to see here is people, business owners who own their real estate, but do not charge themselves the correct market rent. Because if you don't do that, when we come to calculate the true net of the business, we've got to hypothecate the rents that you should have paid and take that off the profits and hence devalue your business. Because every business in the world has something called an occupancy cost. Even a little girl doing medical coding in her front bedroom has got an occupancy cost. She's got a proportion of the mortgage, the rent, whatever it is she's paying. You cannot operate a business without paying for the true cost for that space. I had a business, very, very nice business. He repackaged aerosol paint for some of the biggest people in the country, Ford Motor Company, Volvo, Freightliner, Sherwin-Williams. You know, anytime you pick up one of those paints of touch, those touch-up aerosols, it was probably done by his company or something like someone like him. Well, he'd been having some health issues. I think he'd had 2 or 3 bouts of cancer and he'd recovered, but he wasn't happy about the fact that we were taking the true rent, because it was a purpose-built building that they built specifically to be in line with the fire marshals, because, of course, they had very flammable liquids there and aerosols and all that sort of thing. And so it had also some very special bells and whistles on it to keep it safe. And we had plenty of offers on the business. But none of them came up to where he wanted it.
So let me just understand the dynamics of what his issues were, is that he came to you, you looked at the business, you looked at the financial statements, you said, well, where's the rent? And he said, well, we don't charge rent because we own the building and it's paid off.
Exactly.
And so because of that, you had to add in a market value for rent. And when you add in additional expenses,
yes,
then the profit goes down.
Exactly.
And that affects the valuation of the business. So he wasn't pleased with the adjusted valuation that you were proposing.
Exactly. Not at all. And his argument was, well, the CPA never told me. I actually did at a subsequent time manage to speak to the CPA. And the CPA's answer was, well, he never asked. We didn't know to ask. But CPAs, this is just an aside, CPAs are reactive rather than proactive. But that's a different story altogether. But anyway, so one day after we'd shown it several times, a lot of interest in the business, but nobody ever gave him the right price. And as I was leaving, the wife thrust a piece of paper into my hand and whispered to me, "Get me that number, we'll sell." So I went back to one of my original buyers who'd looked at it and said, "Look, if you write an offer for this, I think we can get this done." Well, I got a buyer to write the offer, took it back by them, which time he'd got over his most recent bout of cancer. And he said, "Oh, no, 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 we're not selling for this. No, 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 definitely not." Unfortunately, you know, you don't get cancer once or twice or three times. Generally speaking, once you've had it more than twice, you've got it forever. And sure enough, he passed away less than 3 months later. The problem was then the seller's wife, who was not technical in any way, shape, or form in the paint area, basically just had to shut the doors.
They didn't have any general manager or someone that could run the business.
No, it wasn't high tech. He had the knowledge in his head and he was the manager, but they had no middle management whatsoever. No, they had just, you know, basic workers who came in and, you know, worked the machines and did what they were supposed to do. But the wife didn't know enough to be able to run the business because she didn't have a technical background like her husband had had. And she did very good books and records. She just didn't know the technical aspects of the business. And so that building is probably still sitting in the middle of North Carolina. If somebody had to buy it, they'd probably have to make massive modifications to it. I don't think that building would ever have been sold. The moral of the story here is if you have real estate and you own the real estate, whether you own it personally or in a separate corporation, make sure your business charges itself back the correct market rent, or better, charges more than the correct rent, because then we can add that extra as an adjustment to the profit. It's additional profit. And a rent is the best way to get money out of a business. There's no FICA paid or due on rent. It's just pure cash.
So I guess the big takeaway for this story is that if, in fact, he had gotten good advice and had been charging rent, there would have been no big surprises when you ran the valuation of the business, and he would have probably been satisfied with the offers that you brought, because the offers that you brought were for what was being represented at the time with the adjusted rent included, and he'd have probably been happy.
And they would have sold the real estate, because the real estate needed to go with the business.
And so what it could have been millions of dollars of exit for them in value when he passed away unexpectedly, the business and the real estate, because they're coupled together and one without the other isn't worth very much. And the business closed and the real estate is probably still sitting there. And again, we have a situation here where the business went to zero because of inadequate planning and having a real exit strategy in mind and being able to position the business for an exit.
Right, exactly.
Well, those are real sobering stories. Why don't we talk about one that has a little bit better outcome? Something that we can leave here saying that businesses do get sold and sold for a lot of money.
Well, I think one of my most pleasant stories, because they were really a very nice old couple, I got a call from a CPA. He didn't tell me what the business was. He didn't share any numbers with me, but he asked me to come to a meeting at his office at 7:30 in the morning. So I'm sitting there 7:20, 7:25, waiting to go into the meeting. And this battered old truck limps into his parking lot and out get these two old people. We go into his office, we do the introductions, and it turns out it's nothing more or less than what most people these days would call a junkyard. But oh no, no, it's a recycling facility. And that makes a big difference when you're trying to sell something. Recycling is big money these days. Well, when we'd done the introductions, the CPA slides the tax return across the table to me, and I nearly fell on the floor. This old couple were making millions to the bottom line. I mean, they were very, very profitable, ran a very good company. The main challenges we had in that transaction were overcome one of the biggest challenges was confidentiality, because they didn't want any of the employees to know until the deal was done, as most people don't. And there was a gal, they called her. Well, this gal was in her 60s. This business had been founded by the couple's father, the brother and sister's father. And this gal had been there from, you know, almost from day one. And she did all the books and records. Now, they knew how to buy and sell scrap metal and plastic, but they didn't know the inner financial workings of the business. And we knew once we got into due diligence with a buyer that questions would be answered. And sure enough, they were, and they didn't know the answers. So we had to have what one will call a come to Jesus meeting at the CPA's office. And the CPA had to explain to them, look, you're going to have to let this lady know you're for sale, because you don't have the answers. She does. And sure enough, everything worked out nicely. The buyers obviously wanted her because of her knowledge. And, you know, she was worried because she had grandchildren to bring up, and she wanted to make sure she had a job. And the only other sort of challenge we had, which could have been a challenge, but in fact, it turned out not to be. As I mentioned, the business had been started by the brother and sister's father. And the sister had kept the old man's office almost like a shrine. His desk was still there. His nameplate was still on the desk. And all the way around the walls were these aerial photographs of the land, because it was about 23, 24 acres. And when the lady came from the EPA, because there was going to be some lending on the land, she introduced herself as your local tree hugger. And she came and she did her inspection of everything. And
I would imagine that the reason that the inspection is because there were some automotive related issues here. And that generally means that land can be contaminated.
Right, exactly. They knew what was going on there. They knew, you know, what it was. It wasn't virgin land anymore. Generally, the banks will call for what they call a phase one is just to look around and a look at the records. And a phase two would be to go around and actually physically look at stuff, which is what she was doing. But she was very satisfied. There were no issues. And as she's leaving, the daughter showed her the father's office. And she's looking around, and then she suddenly realizes that when she sees these photographs on the wall, that this land hadn't always been paved. So she decided we'd better drill some cores. Well, as it happened, they all came back clean, so everything worked out nicely. But the EPA and environmental issues are becoming more and more of a challenge for people because of the way EPA law is. It applies to everybody who ever owned the land, everybody who will own the land, and any bank that's ever lent money to the land. So the banks are very, very careful never to lend money to a piece of real estate that's got any sort of environmental liability whatsoever, because they themselves have made themselves liable partially as well. And of course, you know, the banks are the people with the deep pockets.
So what is that really called on the liability? What do they refer to that liability law?
Well, basically, environmental liability is joint, several, and in perpetua. It goes on forever.
So in perpetua is a Latin term, right?
Yes, yes. That's a legal Latin term. But basically, joint means that everybody who's ever owned it, even if they weren't responsible for it, it has got some liability. And several means that more than one, I believe, and I'm not an attorney, but the attorney told me joint, several, and in perpetua. Several means that more than one person can be liable, and in perpetua means it goes on forever. So there's no cutoff, you know. So that's why people have got to be very careful if you've got any environmental liability on your real estate that you own. But they had charged themselves the correct rents. There was no real estate issues there. And in fact, the business was so profitable, the rent was almost negligible. Depending on what your business is, the rent can be, you know, as high as maybe 30, 35% of your sales, effectively. So it could be of your expenses.
So we have a situation here, highly profitable business, well run, been around a long time. As you said, you nearly fell off the chair when you saw the amount of money they were pulling to the bottom line in the millions of dollars annually. I would imagine that once you brought buyers to the table, it didn't take long to put together an offer.
No, we had it under contract within a month, and I actually had people starting to get cross with me because we wouldn't show it because it had a no-show provision in the contract.
So, for our listeners out there, why don't you talk a little bit about what a no-show clause is?
Buying a business isn't like buying a house or a car. There's a lot of due diligence and inquiries that need to be made. And that due diligence, especially if you're employing attorneys and CPAs, can get expensive. It's not uncommon on a good-sized business to have maybe $100,000 worth of due diligence. And in order to give the buyer time to do that due diligence, they don't want to basically do all that due diligence work and then find that the business has been sold from under them. So when the offer or the letter of intent's been signed, there's often what's called a no-show provision, which means we aren't allowed to show it to anybody else. The seller can't talk to anybody else about it. So it's basically held in stasis while the buyer who's doing their due diligence, and the due diligence isn't to decide whether they want the business, it's to check out that the information they've been given is the correct information before we close the deal.
So you're saying that because the profitability was so much, there was a lot of people interested in the business, and once it went under contract, they couldn't look at it, and they were real peeved that they couldn't get access to the records.
Yeah, they couldn't believe that, you know, because some people have these websites marked. They know how long a business has been on the market, and when it had only been on the market just for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, they couldn't believe it was already under contract, and why couldn't they see it? And also, it was a business that didn't require an awful lot of any particular skills. So it wasn't like an engineering business where we will only show engineering businesses to engineers. When I was in Charlotte, we used to see these what I call Wall Street Yahoos with their 401ks, and they think they know all about business, and they think because they've got the money, they can buy a machine shop. But we wouldn't even show a machine shop to anybody that didn't have an engineering degree, because there's no point in walking in as a buyer, walking into a business where the help knows more than you do. And that would be the situation with some of those Wall Street people. You know, when we put a business on the market and we're trying to vet the buyers, that's one of the first things we do. We make sure they've got the skill set to actually run the business. And obviously a business like this, which is very general, recycling, you really didn't need to know that much. You know, it was in a city where there were a lot of bankers, and so they all thought they knew a lot about business as well. And so, you know, they were the sort of people who were looking at this business because it made so much money.
So I guess the big takeaway on this, if there is a takeaway, is that when you have a business that may have potential EPA issues with environmental concerns, especially when you're dealing with land, you better make sure that you are properly positioned and do the right inspections and remediation that needs to be done well before the sale, so that you can come to the table with the right understanding of what the implications of that are going to be, and that you've reduced the liability to the new buyer of the property as well as his banker, so they'll lend on the land.
Very much so. I actually turned down. After that, I was referred because, you know, the word got round that we'd sold this, and several of his competitors called me, and one I went and looked at, and he was insistent he needed to sell the real estate and the house, and I could see it was unpaved. It was a nightmare. It was going to be an EPA nightmare, and I just said, I'm sorry. This is probably for what you want. You know, you want to sell it for the value of the real estate, it's not going to happen because it was so contaminated. It wasn't paved. It had been around for 40, 50 years with junk cars and oil and antifreeze leaking into the soil and all sorts of nasty stuff. And they were insistent that they wanted to sell the real estate. I think in the end, what they did in that case was basically give it to the daughter. So they just passed the headache on at some point You know, in some situations, and just talking about EPA here, there are some communities that will not allow or will not give planning permission to dry cleaners who use the old sort of dry cleaning fluid, because that perk, as they call it, is insidious. It gets into every crack and every crevice. And in order to get rid of the dirt, I've seen massive craters had to be dug underneath one particular place where the flooring, the base that it was built, this store was built on, it cracked, and this dry cleaning fluid went into the soil underneath. And you know, this crater was 30 or 40 feet deep. And that's how deep they needed to go to get to a point where the soil was clean, because it gets into everything. And a lot of strip centers now won't allow those dry cleaning people in for that reason.
Well, these are some really great takeaways, Peter. I really appreciate you sharing the time with us today to share these stories and the benefit of your experience. If someone wanted to reach out and get a hold of you in Las Vegas or any place else, how would they do that?
Best way, I guess, is through the internet. It's P as in Peter, Coleman, at sunbeltlvforlasvegas.com.
That's easy enough to remember. And we'll also have your contact information on our website with our show notes. Peter, again, thank you very much for being with us today. And until next time, where we'll share more business exit stories and the takeaways that go along with them, we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Join us on our next episode when our guests will share more stories of how entrepreneurs, founders, and business owners have exited their businesses and learn about what to avoid and what you need to do to successfully position your business for a successful exit. If you enjoyed this podcast, take a minute to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts so aspiring entrepreneurs everywhere can find us. If you wish to reach out to any of our guests, please visit our website at www.businessexitstories.com, where you can find more information. Join us next time for more business exit stories.